Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Sarah K. Dreyer, a PhD candidate at the University of Washington who is studying comparative politics, law and human rights, and religion after having completed her undergraduate work in philosophy and legal studies at Northwestern University and a master's at the University of the Basque Country. Her research focuses on religion and political governance in post-colonial contexts, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. Sarah's research incorporates comparative politics scholarship, qualitative and quantitative methods, colonial post-colonial theories, comparative religion, and international human rights scholarship into her research. She has received a number of grants to conduct language training and fieldwork in Africa from the Center for Human Rights, the Harry Bridges Center for Labor Rights, the Chester Fritz Fellowship, the Foreign Language and Area Studies Fellowship, the Ottenberg-Winans Fund, the Association for the Sociology of Religion, and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Ms. Dreyer previously directed the International Policy Portfolio for the Episcopal Church and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Washington, D.C., served as a researcher at the Center for American Progress, and was a board member and/or consultant for a variety of international development and advocacy organizations, including Bread for the World, Humanity United, and the Episcopal Church. Sarah has published in outlets such as International Studies Quarterly, Luther's Seminary Word and World, the Center for American Progress, and the Christian Science Monitor. Links, as always, on our website, so come by and visit us because we would love the company. Sarah, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, you have a lot of experience in the nonprofit sector, especially with religious NGOs or non-governmental organizations, as we call them in the social sciences. What took you on this career path coming out of your undergraduate education, and how did you end up pursuing a PhD in political science at the University of Washington?
Sure. Well, as many things do, I think that there's some credit lies with my parents and my upbringing. My parents are both Lutheran clergy in Minnesota, and they, at an early age, modeled for my brother and sister and me the idea that being Lutheran and being a person of faith requires that we are publicly engaged and engaged in social justice issues and bringing our faith and sort of channeling our faith into the public sphere and the public arena. And so I think I was predisposed to pursue a career in the sort of NGO public engagement realm, broadly defined. And as I began to come of age, I became more and more frustrated with what I at the time sort of understood as the misappropriation of religion in public discourses. So the use and manipulation of theological principles and personal convictions for political ends. I mean, I know that that's a little bit of a heated statement, but I did become concerned with what I sort of understood as this sort of misappropriation of religion. Something that that I think social science tools gives us some really, really valuable tools and venues for exploring and exposing.
Now, were you thinking about this way ahead when you were thinking about which colleges to go to, or did this come about when you were at Northwestern or that? Because if you were thinking about this in high school, you're way ahead of the curve on stuff.
Well, I was thinking about it a little bit in high school because I was beginning to encounter people who had very, very partisan attachments to their – or attached very partisan – expectations to religious belief, and that went really counter to that sort of fundamentalism, not fundamentalism in a religious term, but fundamentalism in a sort of political ideology term went really counter to what my parents had modeled. And so even in high school, I was starting to become very concerned and confronted with these, what I understood to be misappropriations of religion and public discourse. But then in college, it sort of crystallized, and I encountered a variety encountered the sort of social science tools for understanding these dynamics as a legal studies major. But really what crystallized a lot of my interest was my philosophy thesis advisor, who was a scholar by the name of Solomon Bashir Dien, and he's a Senegalese philosopher now at Columbia University. And with him, I worked on a master's thesis, or sorry, an undergrad thesis about exploring African philosophy and how, you know, the tools that it has to sort of move and change and evolve according, you know, to sort of incorporate new social science, or not social science, new social dynamics. So that it all sort of is part of this general trajectory of me wanting to be engaged with the role of religion and epistemology and ontology in shaping how people are able to understand and either incorporate or resist social science or changes in our social world.
So you use those words, epistemology and ontology, there, which are great words. I keep having to relearn those every couple episodes here when people use them. But those are really academic words, but you actually went and put boots on the ground by working with non-governmental organizations instead of going to academia or the academic path right away. What kind of took you into that NGO world?
Right. So the first job I had out of college was the Center for American Progress, which is a think tank, a research institution in D.C. And that I was working for their, they had a little initiative called the Faith and Progressive Politics or Policy Initiative. And so the task that we had was to take these theological concepts and these ideas about, you know, people's religious beliefs and convictions and elevate, you know, it was a partisan think tank. So our task was to sort of elevate the compatibility between, Islamic teaching, Christian teaching, Jewish teaching, and progressive political agendas. So it was a little bit of I guess the role was translation, or I mean, not translation. It was bringing these complex concepts into dialogue with one another and trying to figure out a way to present that for public consumption, I suppose. So we did that, and then I worked as the person in charge of the international policy portfolio for the Episcopal Church and for the Lutheran Church. And once again, the task was to understand social inequality, global social inequality and social injustice, using Lutheran and Episcopal Anglican connections as a sort of venue for understanding these global dynamics. In other words, you know, we were able to have a sense for how U.S. policy was impacting vulnerable people in South Sudan or in Indonesia by being in conversation with the Lutheran Church and the Anglican churches on the ground in those contexts.
Now, I'm a little bit curious about that. Did the Anglican Church and the ECLA or ELCA,
right,
did they actually cooperate in this endeavor? They were in the same office space, or did you run between them two and they were separate?
I ran between the two.
Oh, okay.
I was the first Both the Episcopal Church and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America have Washington-based advocacy offices, and they both happened to have vacancy in the international policy portfolio at the same time, and the two people who had fulfilled those roles independently, you know, had routinely gone to all of the same meetings and done all of the same analysis, and then distributed it to their own networks. And so they came together and they decided that they could efficiently hire one person to be in charge of managing both of those portfolios. And so I had two different offices and two different global networks to be in engagement with, which was obviously a really, really enormous job, and one that is, could have a whole office working on. But one of the really important things that I learned in that particular role was that we weren't interested in finding from a theological standpoint, we weren't interested in finding a least common denominator approach to channeling our theology into public policy. What we were interested in doing was sort of finding what was uniquely Episcopalian about being engaged as a public as a public actor, and what was uniquely Lutheran about being engaged as a public actor, and bringing those two together, and so using the unique strengths of what it means to be Episcopalian and the unique strengths of what it means to be Lutheran in order to speak to both of our networks individually and also collectively.
That sounds really neat, and I can see how this slingshots you into the academic world, because your dissertation topic really touches a lot on some of the themes that you were doing in your NGO work. So what did bring you eventually to think about becoming an academic?
Well, I think I was always predisposed. I mean, I think I always thought of myself as an academic. It wasn't so much for me a question of whether I would do that, but when and in what particular discipline. My parents, again, are both, you know, intellectuals in their own right, and really modeled the value of knowledge and understanding that you get from scholarship in order to be able to analyze the social world, which doesn't answer your question or anyone's question. But to answer your question about what inspired me to take my work into academia, I'm gonna fall back on an anecdote. And this is an anecdote from when I was serving as the international policy and advocacy representative for the Lutheran Church and the Episcopal Church. And I was in South Sudan with one of my colleagues from the Lutheran World Federation, and we were evaluating a malaria initiative that the Lutheran Church through the Lutheran World Federation had been funding throughout South Sudan. And it was 2012, so it was 1 year after South Sudan's independence. So it was our world's newest country and only 1 year old. And South Sudan has incredible amounts of poverty and illiteracy and an ethnic conflict and ethnic tensions, which, if anyone's following the news today, is really, really gripping the new country as we speak. But at the time, there was some percolating ethnic tensions. So they had a lot of really pressing health, poverty, and conflict-related issues that were really threatening the lives and livelihood of South Sudanese. So I was there with my colleague evaluating this malaria initiative project, and we happened to be at the same in the same city that the Anglican or the Episcopal primate, the Episcopal Archbishop of Sudan and South Sudan was in. Archbishop Daniel Dangbol was in the same town that we were because he had been commissioned by the president of South Sudan to lead up peace and reconciliation talks between some of the country's most conflicting ethnic tribes. So he was president appointed to do this enormous, responsible for this enormous task. And he had agreed to take the time to meet with me. And I was, had been in this position, my position for about a year. And so I was really eager to meet with him and to talk about malaria and to learn a little bit more about his work, you know, dealing with this ethnic conflict, and these ethnic challenges and tensions. And I sat down and I introduced myself to him. And the first thing he said to me was, I just need to say one thing. And that is that I need your church, the Episcopal Church, to hold off and back down from its homosexuality agenda. And I was totally taken aback because I knew that this was an issue that was challenging the Episcopal Church's relationship with churches throughout the region, but it was striking to me to see that in a context in which this archbishop, who had done incredible work for his people in Sudan and South Sudan, who weathered the civil war and all of the challenges related to building a new state, and who was facing all of these really, really pressing challenges, wanted to bother himself and me with having this conversation about LGBT rights, which seemed to me not frivolous, but it seemed to me that it was not as important as for us to discuss in relationship with one another as some of these other issues that he had facing him. And so I really wanted to get to the bottom of what it is about these transnational religious networks that works and what it is that doesn't work, and to really understand why it is that this question of LGBT rights had become so definitive and so defining for the relationships between American churches and European churches and churches throughout the global South, and in particular sub-Saharan Africa, which is where I focus my research.
Yeah, and that is what your current research and soon-to-be-published article in ISQ, it's under a conditional accept, but we have a lot of optimism about because it's a fascinating paper. That's what all that research deals with, how these African churches within both the Lutheran denomination and within the Anglican Communion are responding to some of these significant cultural changes going on within the European and U.S. branches of those faith traditions. Some of our listeners might not be as familiar with what is going on in those denominations. So if you could give us a sense for what's happening amongst the Episcopalians and Lutherans on this dimension, that'd be great.
Sure. So churches, you know, there's we've got lots of social science that talks about the ways in which churches evolve or change alongside and along with society. And there are a number of examples in the last, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years in which the churches have been important venues for social change. I'm thinking about things like advocating for a variety of development agendas, you know, churches' efforts and denominational moves to begin to ordain women and cultivate female leadership, church efforts to force communities and societies to take seriously issues like gender-based violence, these sorts of things. Churches are both changing as society changes, and also really pushing, in a lot of ways, pushing social communities to update and change their practices that have been deemed harmful. And in so many examples, transnational religious networks like the Anglican Communion or the Lutheran World Federation have been really, really valuable venues for facilitating that change. And that sort of halted or came to a head or became challenged at the turn of the 21st century, when American churches and a variety of churches throughout Western Europe began ordaining openly gay and lesbian clergy, bishops, and sanctioning and condoning same-sex unions, and then eventually same-sex marriages. So in 2003, the Episcopal Church, the U.S.-based Episcopal Church, ordained its first openly gay bishop, and then by 2015, they had approved, they had updated their official marriage ceremonies to incorporate same-sex marriages and approved the ordination of transgender clergy. The ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, in 2009 elected to allow individual congregations to ordain openly gay and lesbian clergy and to conduct same-sex marriages or same-sex unions if they wanted to. And these decisions really catapulted us into what have been termed global culture wars or global schisms that have in some ways really threatened the very fabric of these transnational networks, where Lutheran churches and Anglican churches throughout the global South have really resisted and criticized the churches in the United States and Western Europe for taking these steps that African leaders and leaders throughout the global South interpret as turning their back on the biblical principles that unite Anglicans and Lutherans in these global networks to begin with. So for turning their back on these critical biblical principles, and also in so doing, then imposing their sort of, in an imperial kind of way, imposing their sort of secular embrace of LGBT rights onto churches throughout sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, a lot of this has generated controversy here in the United States, and I know the number of Episcopal churches have been seeing rifts within their denomination, some people picking up and leaving either individually or sometimes by entire congregations, in similar ways with Lutherans, maybe not as pronounced, but still happening as well.
Exactly, and it's worth pointing out, I mean, none of these issues that we've mentioned are sort of resolved or without controversy anywhere. And, you know, both the Episcopal Church and the Lutheran Church and several other denominations are dealing with these intense internal debates as well over the question of LGBT rights and inclusion.
And if you just kind of take a big global or global cultural perspective on this, you can see that a lot of these norms are changing relatively quickly, or have been for a while in Europe and the United States, but not so much in Africa. So you can imagine that the schisms are going to be a lot more pronounced, I think, in some of those areas. So how has Africa reacted to looking overseas and saying, "Whoa, what are you folks doing?"
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. So the first is that the vast majority of Lutheran and Anglican churches throughout sub-Saharan Africa, there's a couple of exceptions. South Africa is the South African Anglican Church is one exception. But the vast majority of Lutheran and Anglican churches have responded with statements where they publicly repudiate the Western, for lack of a better word, the global North churches for adopting these policies that they consider to be unbiblical. So they've all sort of issued these public statements that say, you know, we strongly disagree with the steps that these churches have taken. Some have said, nevertheless, we effectively agree to disagree. And what's important to point out is that the Anglican Communion and the Lutheran World Federation are not analogs to the Catholic Church, for example. So what the Lutheran churches in the United States or in Sweden or in Germany do is only governing their national church body. There're consortiums of autonomous, mostly national church bodies, and so the vast majority of Lutheran churches in Africa and most Anglican churches in Africa have sort of agreed to disagree and have said, "What you do in the U.S. is what is your business. We're not going to adopt the same policies here, and we are going to continue to have our relationships with you that we've always had unencumbered by this disagreement." Some Anglican churches, in particular, the Anglican churches in Kenya and Tanzania, responded by sort of saying, look, our relationship is a little strained as a result of our disagreement over homosexuality. And it's not entirely clear what that means, but we're going to continue to remain in partnership with you for a variety of reasons or in a variety of venues. But that your decision to begin to ordain openly gay and lesbian clergy and sanction same-sex marriages is undermining that relationship in some important ways. And then others have responded by saying, we can no longer be in partnership with you. We can no longer accept funding from American development efforts, from the Episcopal Church or from the Lutheran Church, and we can no longer have bilateral relationships with you at all. We effectively have no relationship with you. So we've got this variation in how churches have responded to this schism, but I think it's important to point out that regardless of this variation, all of the churches have sort of said in one way or another, have made very clear to their own constituents that they disagree with these more LGBT inclusive moves that have been going on in the United States and Europe.
But it's that variation that is really cool, and that variation that every enterprising graduate student seeks out so that they can build a dissertation and explain things. So this is really cool. And you go about and you use some previous research relating to transnational organizations. We have a good group of scholars here at the University of Washington that focuses on non-governmental and transnational organizations. So summarize what some of the thinking is on these transnational groups in general before we turn to how these relationships are affected in the religious realm in Africa.
Sure. And I'll do my best to stay away from the weeds of the social science lingo. But so there's this this sort of well-known idea of transnational norm diffusion, this idea that networks of individuals and of people transnationally can sort of really work together to facilitate change on the ground in a variety of contexts. So transnational networks of people, of individuals, in this case of bishops and archbishops and congregations, meet together. They're in cross-cultural dialogue with one another. They share sources of information. They share sources of education. And in this process of transnational cross-cultural dialogue, that they're then able to go to their own contexts and begin to disseminate new approaches to social justice issues or new ideas about addressing gender-based violence or women's empowerment and these kinds of things. And it's sort of a rosy picture of transnationalism, of course. But in a lot of ways, the transnational religious networks have functioned in this kind of way, particularly in the cases of looking at, you know, women's rights and women's empowerment issues. And they do fancy themselves as being able to facilitate this change, also in the case of protections and recognition for LGBT individuals. But of course, the social science literature has appropriately begun to sort of qualify this original rosy picture of transnationalism. And so we look at things like the fact that these transnational networks inevitably have power differentials and inevitably reflect global inequalities. So individuals and actors in developing countries, for lack of a better term, in global South countries that have had less influence in shaping international norms and transnational discourses, feel as though these ideas are imposed upon them. And furthermore, they are in many cases still dependent on the sort of goodwill, again, for lack of a better term, from the United States and from Europe for funding a variety of institutional and development initiatives. So we've got actors who feel less powerful and who are less powerful, who have less access to resources, who are more reliant on people elsewhere in the world, and who have had less say in shaping what could be deemed global norms, and that this transnationalism literature ignores the fact that transnationalism has sort of has active actors and sort of passive recipients. So what they do is they look at things like understanding the fact that wealthier actors than can sort of incentivize people to or communities to adopt the norms that they prefer by using funding as a carrot to inspire compliance, and looking at other material incentives that have shaped these transnational networks of norm diffusion. And then there's also some really important real literature that's looking at noncompliance, at backlashes that we see throughout the world, resistance to these transnational norms. And I want to point out like a couple of causes for this backlash. The first one, and one that is really important to highlight, is that there are still genuine disagreements and there is genuine incompatibility between the values and the normative commitments that we see in communities throughout the world. And the case of LGBT rights is a really important one. There are genuine disagreements in terms of where the ethics lie with regard to LGBT rights. And so resistance that we see throughout sub-Saharan Africa to the gay rights issue really is shaped in large part by these genuine disagreements. So I don't want to invalidate that, the importance of that. But a second explanation or a second component of resistance to these transnational norm diffusion ideas or to transnational norms is that peripheral actors do feel marginalized. They feel as though they are part of an international community and an international legal and normative structure and political structure and market economy that they had very little role in building. And that's a really important point. And the other thing that Tony pointed out earlier is that this is this issue of gay rights, for example, is unresolved in the United States as well as it is in sub-Saharan Africa. So there are wealthy global actors or wealthy global North actors on both sides of this debate using their financial resources and their networks in order to peddle their particular agenda.
So this is really interesting, and I love the explaining of this variation here, and you're really moving the literature forward in specifically looking at religious institutions here. So let's talk about this specific issue with the specific actors you're looking at, namely the Episcopalians, or also known as the Anglicans or Anglican Communion, as well as the Lutherans as well. You go down and do a bunch of field work, and we'll talk about the field work here in a specific, but you find some churches that hear this dialogue and say, you know what, we want to have nothing to do with this. Go pound sand. We're leaving, breaking away from you. And other ones that say, okay, you're saying that, we don't really like it, but we're still going to stay connected to you. How do you explain that variation? What is your specific argument that you're making here in your articles and dissertation?
Sure. So the first, we start with ideology. And it's important to point out that generally speaking, throughout sub-Saharan Africa, there tends to be fairly comparable commitment, opposition to LGBT rights throughout the continent. There's not a whole lot of variation in ideology. So I don't want to say that these aren't genuine commitments that need to be taken seriously. They are genuine commitments, but the genuine commitments don't explain the variation that Tony pointed out and that I identify in my research. So for the purposes of explaining this variation, I put ideology aside. And I identify a fairly simple cost-benefit scheme for understanding why churches have responded the way that they have. And the cost that I let's start with the cost side of the coin. The cost affiliated with breaking with their transnational networks and their U.S. counterparts is pretty simple. It's just a surrendering of financial resources and at some contexts, really well-established multi-generational networks of relationships with American Lutherans or Episcopalians or Swedish Lutherans, for example. So this is the cost that churches decide to surrender if they want to break with their counterparts. And I come up with, I think, a fairly meaningful explanation for what explains why some institutions, some churches are able to absorb this cost. And that is simply their own domestic institutional stability and their relative independence from Western funding. Churches that are larger, which means that they've got a stronger foothold in their own countries and have more access to resources from within Uganda or within Nigeria, for example, tend to be more likely to have broken with their counterparts in the United States and Western Europe. Of those who are, there are some, like, fairly small churches that have also broken. But if you look at the institutional history of those particular churches, what we can see is that they have less specific financial reliability or dependence on these more, quote, progressive global North counterparts. So churches that are bigger or are just less financially reliant on the progressive churches, progressive, you know, global North churches tend to be the ones that have decided, you know what, I'm going to surrender these costs that I get or these benefits that I get from remaining in collaboration with the United States. And and instead be able to, well, just these are the ones who say, I'm going to surrender the benefits that I get from the American churches.
Now, are there some sources for finding alternative sources of funding? You mentioned earlier that this, you know, these issues are not resolved within the United States or in Europe, and some churches, you know, decide to tell the Episcopalians to go their own way, mm-hmm. and they have resources. Could they say, hey, you know, in Africa, if you don't want to, you know, continue with the Anglican Communion, we'll throw you a big bag of money our way?
Yeah, there's been there's been a lot of that. It's not. That funding it's there. There's not a whole lot of clear cut evidence for actually or public like available information about how much that is. But there are a couple of reasons to believe that sources of funding don't offset the institutional support that they would have gotten from the Lutheran and the Episcopalian churches. Those sources tend to be in some. There are some cases in which that funding has been more earmarked and limited. You know, to say we don't want to fund your, because these are more conservative Americans, they will say, we don't want to fund your women's office, for example, because we don't actually think that women should be ordained, even though you are ordaining women. They're limited in that regard, or they're sort of one-off big ticket incentives that can be used to support, or just can be absorbed by, you know, a specific archbishop, and doesn't necessarily need to be like distributed to support the institutional structure. So there are these really important conservative sources of funding, but I don't think that they entirely offset. The amount of money that these institutions would be getting from the sort of more mainline, deeply embedded relationships that they had with the mainstream Episcopal or Lutheran churches.
Okay, so that cost there is important. You lose that long-term funding, long-term networks, and
predictable.
Predictable funding, right. That kind of thing. You might get a one-time payoff from somebody, but it's not long-term. So still, there's not a whole lot of incentive. I mean, you're worried about where is our funding going to come from. You mentioned that there's another factor as well in your work that influences whether churches decide to tell the Anglican Communion or the Lutherans to take a hike. What was that one?
Yeah, so this cost that they surrender, I would argue, is the sort of cleanest empirical explanation for what explains why these churches are willing to leave, or are able to leave. But what it doesn't explain to us is what benefits they get by doing that. It doesn't tell us why they would feel the need to do so to begin with. And this gets, you know, what is it that they think that they're gaining by making these definitive statements and these definitive breaks? And this pushes me to get on the ground, to do the field work and to talk to these leaders to figure out what they felt was at stake if they didn't do that. And it turns out that, and this is, you know, I'm making this assertion based on my interviews with, you know, more than 50 religious leaders in Ethiopia and Uganda. They really perceive that they needed to signal to their constituents that they were on the side of Ugandans or on the side of Ethiopians, for example, when it comes to this issue of LGBT rights. And the reason they need to do this, one of the reasons that they need to do this, is because mainline churches or churches that have these denominational networks with, you know, Anglicans, with Lutherans, with Presbyterians and Methodists, as opposed to Pentecostal churches. Mainline churches are becoming increasingly threatened by this the Pentecost, like African independent and Pentecostal churches that are growing like wildfire in throughout the continent, and especially in metropolitan centers. But it also is starting to bleed into rural areas where these independent Pentecostal movements are, as one leader put it, they're stealing or they're fishing from Lutheran and Anglican and Methodist ponds. I mean, that's a metaphor that, you know, someone I spoke with in Kenya said that they're fishing from our ponds. So these mainline churches are feeling threatened by Pentecostal movements, and in this arena of intense religious threat and religious competition, they need every tool at their disposal to sort of like leverage their competition with one another. And what we see is that the Pentecostal churches are very willing to frame Anglican African churches or brand, you know, Lutheran African churches as being part of the homosexual church, in air quotes, right? If these churches don't take a hard stance against the LGBT inclusion policies taken by their churches in the United States, then these African churches risk being branded as sort of implicit or implicitly or guilty by association with the churches in the United States, so in Western Europe. So we see these leaders making very, very public statements where they're disavowing themselves from the Lutheran Church, and they're presenting themselves as champions of Ugandan norms or champions of the ideas that Kenyans or Tanzanians or Ethiopians really are wedded to, i.e., champions of opposing homosexuality, in order to signal to their constituents, hey, we're on your side. You don't have to leave and go to this Pentecostal church across the street. So in a sense, this global debate over LGBT rights becomes something that is a liability to the churches on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I just have an interesting question. I think about this strategically. There's a lot of Pentecostals out there, and a lot of these churches are doing well. Some of them are very small, storefront types of churches. Others are becoming huge mega churches and have huge regional impact. Why don't some of these Anglican churches or Lutheran churches that have been around before just decide to, quote unquote, go Pentecostal?
Well, okay, that's a great question. They have in their ecclesiology and in their liturgy, and in some ways in their theology. I mean, I've spoken with a number of leaders who say, look, the charismatic churches, people are speaking in tongues, they're incorporating all of this worship behavior that is not often affiliated with the kind of like stuffy Western Europe American approaches to liturgy, for example. And so they say, we have to do this. And if we don't, the people will leave to go to the charismatic church. So in a way, they're sort of taking their own institution and becoming Pentecostalized. But that's different from just, as you say, becoming Pentecostal. And I don't have a really good answer for why they're not just saying, you know, relinquishing themselves from the shackles of you know, the global Methodist movement or the global Lutheran movement and just making themselves Pentecostal, except that there is incredible value in the networks that they have, that they inherited from and built upon in the sort of post-colonial independence movements. So as African churches, or as African continent or countries began to gain independence from their colonial rulers, so too did the Anglican churches in throughout sub-Saharan Africa, for example, begin to establish themselves not as missionary wings of the Church Mission Society, the Church of England, but also. But you know, so not just missionary wings of their sort of missionary roots, but their own standalone institutions. So, in this move toward independence, they inherited incredible networks, buildings, land, schools, healthcare services that are like countrywide. And so, one of the things that I think we overlook when we talk about the, you know, growing like wildfire Pentecostal revivalist movement throughout the continent is that, nevertheless, these mainline churches, they're the ones with national networks. They are the ones that have churches and networks that connect Nairobi to Mombasa to, you know, like rural communities throughout Kenya, for example. They have these incredible networks that are both valuable and from a sort of organizing standpoint, valuable from a standpoint of allowing these churches to actually provide really important social services, to begin to advance things like norms that seek to counter gender-based violence, but they're also just I don't know where my sentence started.
Well, I definitely understand what you're saying. It's hard to give up a lot of that stuff, right? If you're a prelate who's invested decades of your own, you know, mental energy, your own, you know, hard work in building these networks, it's just hard to say, well, I'm going to just give it all up one day.
And there's a sentiment among church leaders that their institutions, their mainline institutions, are there for the long game. And I've talked to some Anglican leaders who have said, look, the youth, they go and join the Pentecostal churches. And yes, it's concerning to us. And yes, we're involved in education efforts to keep our young people in our pews, but they will come back. A sense that there's some value to these national institutional networks that a Pentecostal movement, by virtue of lacking those connections and institutional stability, are just fleeting, I suppose. And it is true that, you know, it's starting to change a little bit, but for the most part, Pentecostal churches are one-off institutions. You know, they're one church in Addis, or they're one church in Kampala, you know, or they're not networked in the same way that the institutional churches are. So it's a really long-winded, I'm sorry, way of saying that by focusing on the Pentecostal movement, we as scholars tend to overlook just how important mainline institutions still are. We look at growth rather than absolute numbers of membership. That said, most of this sort of fishing our members is happening in urban centers, which is where national, which is where the bishops are, the archbishops, which is where the church institutions are headquartered. And so they perceive also this pillaging of their membership more poignantly than they would if they were living in more semi-rural or rural communities. So it's a perceived threat. It's a real threat, but we risk. And I do think that in this case, it's driving churches' behavior and their responses to the LGBT issue. But we risk overlooking the importance of these like mainline networks when we don't put that sort of threat in context.
You were talking a moment ago about talking to the individuals on the ground in your field work. And I just want to spend a little bit of time asking you what that was like. A lot of us folks in the listening audience will hear all these results, will read about them in journals or in news reports, but we never really get a sense of how these things were done. And you just came back from field work recently. You've been on the ground a long time in Africa, not only as an academic, but also in your time working with these transnational NGOs. What was it like talking about these issues to a lot of these bishops? I mean, because here comes Sarah Dreyer, who grew up in Minnesota and says, hi, I want to talk to you about, gay clergy and stuff. That must have been a really wild experience.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple of thoughts. The first is that there is something, and I think this vexes social scientists, but there is something that sort of unifies people across cultures when they can identify themselves as Lutheran or as Episcopalian, and or as people of faith in general. I grew up in Minnesota, which is the sort of Lutheran hotbed in the United States, and we had tons and tons of connections with Tanzania, which is the Minnesota of Africa, arguably.
I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Yeah. And there's, there's something that means something to Minnesota and Tanzanian Lutherans, that, we have totally different contexts, we have totally different cultures, we have different social institutions, different professions, different ways of life, and yet there's something about being Lutheran that means that we share something. And maybe that's created, maybe that's just all in our heads, maybe that's just a fallacy of terminology, but nevertheless that feels like it means something. And so as I was able to interview these church leaders, it was meaningful to both them and me that I had these both personal and institutional roots in church networks and in the church. So that was kind of a cool experience that I entered in feeling as if we were in some ways part of a shared endeavor, even though our lives and our situations and our everything else was totally different. So that was really a really useful and a really like meaningful entry point. Now that also introduces challenges because I was still a social scientist and was still interviewing and recording their sentiments for documentation, for public consumption. And I, needed to sort of, it required me to be more clear about who I was in this context. And so that they didn't sort of feel so comfortable with me that they weren't aware that I was conducting social science research. The IRB process was actually really helpful in that regard because it provided me some sort of like institutional requirements that forced me to sort of sit down and say, before we talk, here is what I'm doing, and need to make sure that you understand that that I'm here as a social scientist, even though we sort of share these background identities and affiliations. But anyway, so that was a really meaningful entry point that introduced some challenges, some research challenges, but was also really invaluable. The question about how I approached the particular issue of homosexuality was challenging, and I actually most of the time made the intentional decision to not bring it up on my own. Because I didn't want, I mean, this question of LGBT rights is really challenging. And it really, you know, is something that many people feel deeply about. And so I decided most of the time I asked about, you know, what were the church, you know, I was interviewing church leaders. So I wasn't asking them about their own opinions. I was asking about them about their institutional approaches and their institutional priorities. And I asked them about their church's priorities, what they saw to be the most important social issues that they were working toward. And then I asked them about their transnational connections. And I asked them about, you know, what international or what transnational relationships were most important to them, and what that looked like. And then I asked them, you know, what were the benefits that they got from being in these sort of transnational networks, and what are the challenges that they encountered? And most of the time, over the course of those questions, they raised the issue of homosexuality, which I think is really interesting and really it was just fascinating from a research methodology standpoint.
It's good as well, too, because if you're thinking about this, you don't necessarily want to prompt somebody to their answer. So the fact that they're volunteering this without any prompting, it tells you that, yeah, it's high on the agenda. And for a social scientist, you must walk out of the room and say, yes, this is helping me with my dissertation, which is always really cool.
And it tells you that this is, in fact, undergirding most, if not all, interactions between at least religious actors from the global north and their partners in sub-Saharan Africa. This is on everyone's mind.
So let me ask you a little bit about perhaps the reflection of the clergy and the, you know, folks running the Lutheran and Anglican churches in the global north. Have they picked up on this? I mean, they kind of go down saying, oh, yeah, let's have same-sex marriages, gay clergy, and all of a sudden they go down to Africa and people say no. Do they stop and say, oh, maybe we shouldn't be pushing this as hard. Maybe we should just not worry about this, not make this an issue, find other means of, you know, connecting with these churches so that we can keep everybody within the same family, even though we might have some big disagreements over some critical issues here?
I'm glad you asked that question. Because I think this is an important clarification. The churches that I'm most familiar with, and again, I haven't interviewed for my research the American leaders, in large part because many of these are my former colleagues, and I don't want to exploit those relationships for my own research. But what I can say, and we know just sort of based on, you know, public documentation and you know, public statements, is that these leaders have never thought that this has never been something that they were bringing to their partners. This was never something that they were working to push, you know, in hopes that 5 years from now or 10 years from now or 30 years from now, Lutherans in Tanzania would be on board with their approach to LGBT rights. This has never been part of the agenda. It's always just been something that I think people have wanted to keep within American borders. Like the former presiding bishop of the U.S.-based Episcopal Church said, you know, when the Episcopal Church ordained Gene Robinson in 2003, you know, they got accused of this. This is a sort of new iteration of neocolonial imposition, where the U.S. is imposing its perspective on the rest of the world. And the Episcopal Church's public responses were twofold. The first was, we're not imposing this. This is we want to agree to disagree. We don't want to bring our agenda to your borders. This is not something for you to, you know, this is our autonomous decision that we're a decision that we're making to govern our behavior in the United States or our behavior in Sweden or Germany or wherever, Canada. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, the Episcopal Church, the presiding bishop said, look, I think she went so far as to say that it was reverse colonialism to expect that the U.S. not take the moves that they believed they needed to do in their borders, because the Anglican Communion in general wasn't capable or wasn't prepared. That's the right word. Wasn't prepared to make those same moves. Now, we can really critique from a sort of critical race perspective, we can really critique her use of that particular terminology. But the point is that they really didn't, I think it's safe to say that they didn't, that they've never sort of felt like they were, that this was something that should be part of their global agenda. Now, that said, it's important to distinguish between protecting LGBT individuals and the sort of safety from violence and LGBT inclusion. So, I mean, most, if not all, religious leaders that I talked with in sub-Saharan Africa said, look, you know, these are people of God and we welcome them into our hospitals and we want to, like, make sure that everyone, including LGBT individuals, live free from violence and are safe. And that's something that I think that the churches in the U.S. and sub-Saharan Africa have worked collaboratively on. But that's a different topic than the LGBT rights.
Yeah, there's so many topics here. And it's such an interesting, you know, time to be looking at these changing norms. And even though they want to keep them in borders, it's a transnational network. And there's other players such as Pentecostals bringing these things up. And so it really becomes a kind of a large soap opera of what is going on here. And you are actually doing a really interesting job.
Thanks.
Analyzing this stuff.
And if I may, I mean, I think that everyone is kind of caught off guard by how, you know, nothing that we do stands, remains in our borders right now. And that was, I think that's a really, really valuable learning experience for all of us, you know, any of us who are living in this world today, that institutions, whether they're, you know, government institutions or, you know, the Congress or church institutions or NGOs, like, I mean, whatever, what we do doesn't stay within our borders. And I think that this, you know, I think that leaders in the U.S. and Europe really, I take them seriously when they say, we didn't think that we were making decisions for anyone other than ourselves.
Yeah, it's changing times, interesting times. And that observation that you made there leads me to my final question here. And I always love to ask this of scholars, because scholarship is really a journey, not a destination. And over the course of studying African churches, these transnational networks, and the specific issues you've been looking at, has there anything that you've come across that's really surprised you or perhaps even made you change your mind about how you view the world than, say, 5, 10, 15 years ago?
I'm going to give a cop-out answer. And that is that these dynamics are just constantly shifting and constantly changing and constantly moving. And it would be problematic to make any kind of sweeping statement about what Anglicans in Uganda think about LGBT rights. Even that is far more nuanced and far more informed by personal, informed and shaped by both personal experiences and personal spiritualities than any generalizable statement can take seriously. And I guess that's the, the element of both fear and promise in this research. And that is that people's perspectives are constantly dynamic and constantly shifting and constantly changing. And by virtue of personal experiences and by virtue of looking to leaders that they know and they trust for guidance. And that means that religious leaders and scholars and policymakers, that we all have an incredible responsibility for making sure that what we say and what we model is our ideas and behaviors that we would like to be recreated and replicated among those who are listening to us.
A very, very cool lesson that we have heard many, many times here on Research on Religion. The world is dynamic. The world is changing, and there's a lot of nuance, and which is why we always like to talk to a wide range of scholars, young and old, and here. And so today's guest was Sarah Dreyer. Sarah, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.